we need to talk about ideas, good ones and bad ones. We need to learn stuff about the world. We need an honest, intelligent, thought-provoking, and entertaining review of what the hell happened on this planet in the last 7 days. We need to sit back and listen to the Iron Fist and the Velvet Glove.
Hello and welcome, dear listener. This is the Iron Fist and the Velvet Glove podcast. This is a podcast where we talk about news and politics and sex and religion. And on this occasion, I have a special guest who I consider to be somewhat of an expert when it comes to sex and religion. And he's not too shabby on news and politics as well. Cam Riley, welcome aboard.
I consider myself a bit of an expert on sex too, Trevor. Thanks for asking. Yeah.
Well, you've boasted about it often enough that, I think we all know what you get up to, and congratulations on your efforts.
You've got to advertise. As, my marketing background taught me that, Trev.
Very good. So if you're new to this podcast, every second week we have a little panel discussion where a group of us sit around and talk about the news and events, particularly in relation to Australia and then the wider world. And then every second week I've decided to do something special, either a book review or an interview or something else. And this is that special week. And Cam Riley is the guest this week. And Cam, amongst his many accomplishments, is he's an author, and he wrote a book called The Psychopath Epidemic, Why the World is So Fucked Up and What You Can Do About It. By the way, language warning, normally we don't drop the F-bomb too often in this podcast, but with Cam on board, keep the kids away until you've had a listen to it. And so, Cam, the psychopathic...
Bring your seat backs to their fully upright position and make sure your seat belts are fully fastened.
That's it. If you're watching us live, then make some comments, and hopefully comments you make will appear in the chat room, and they'll start to appear on the screen, and we might answer some questions or whatever that come along. So feel free to make some comments there, and that will impress Cam with the technology on this podcast. So have a go at that. So Cam, the psychopath epidemic, what's the premise of the book? What's the elevator pitch? What's it about?
I know what you're doing here, Trev. You figure I throw Cameron a softball question. I can sit back, put my feet up for the next 45 minutes while he just rattles on. But I'll take the bait and run with it nonetheless. So, the psychopath epidemic, the premise is that the vast majority of the problems facing the world today are the result of psychopaths in position of power and wealth in our major institutions, businesses, religions, politics, the media, the military, the police, education, the list goes on, but they're probably the big five or six that obviously direct a large percentage of the world's affairs. And I came to this conclusion after many, many years of thinking about really, really, if you drill down to it, what's the real problem with what's going on today? And I remember I was writing another book and was thinking about all of these stories that I've collected over the years for my various podcasts about people in positions of authority in all of those sorts of institutions just doing really stupid, bad, heinous, and thinking, why? Like, why? Like, I know humans do that, but why, when you're in a position of authority and power and trust, would you allow yourself, why, if you're Bill Clinton, would you be getting blowjobs in the Oval Office? Like, really, why? I mean, sure, you want to get blowjobs, but there's plenty of other places as the president you could probably do that outside of the actual Oval Office itself. Like that, the risk that you're taking on is insane. It's ridiculous. Anyway, after reading a number of books on psychopaths, coincidentally, and thinking about bosses that I'd had and organizations that I'd worked in, large organizations and small organizations like Microsoft, where I worked for 6 or 7 years, I came to the realization that when you look at the characteristics of people who rank highly on the psychopath test, people who exhibit the classic psychopath behaviors, And then you look at the people that are running these sorts of organizations, there's a very high overlap if you Venn diagram them. And then I started to think about, well, does it make sense that people who had these sorts of characteristics could rise to positions of power in management and these sorts of organizations? And I realized, yes, it does. In fact, that's what you would expect. You would expect a psychopath to be able to rise through the ranks because, famously, they're able to think one thing and say another. They're the smiling assassins. They're the people who learn to exhibit the sorts of behaviors and say the sorts of things that they think people want to hear.
Shall we just give a quick and dirty definition for a psychopath and a sociopath, perhaps?
Yeah, well, it's an interesting, like if you read the medical literature, if you read the DSM-5, the medical establishment's diagnosis of disorders, there's really no distinction between sociopaths and psychopaths. They all get lumped together into antisocial personality disorder. Mm-hmm. Generally, though, when you read sort of the more mainstream literature, there's a little bit of divisiveness around it. But I came to the general conclusion that most psychiatrists who work in this space and clinical psychologists tend to think that the difference is people are born a psychopath or you're made a sociopath. If you experience extreme trauma as a young child around the ages of 4, 5, 6, the classic fictional example I always use is Dexter in the Dexter TV series, saw his mother brutally murdered and then sat in her blood for I think hours before he was rescued. It fucks with your empathy center, your ability to feel empathy and express empathy towards others, among other things. Or you're born with that. And if you go back through history, there's plenty of evidence. It's nothing that would stand up for a clinical psychologist, but there's plenty of evidence that psychopaths have always been with us in one shape or form. It's just that in years gone by, we called them kings and generals and popes and, various other titles, railway barons.
Yep, still trying to get a quick and dirty definition. Would you say something like a psychopath would be somebody with a strong desire for power and a disregard for the rights of others? Like, is this sort of willingness to just walk over and ignore the rights of others seems to be the key part of being a psychopath? Is that really a key part of it?
Yeah, but I want to shout out to the people in the chat room, Tony and Dire Straits, that were in Sydney for the screening of my film, Martin and Messiah. Good on you guys. Thank you. Appreciate that. You made it just before COVID. That was the last thing ever screened in any cinema in Australia before. Yes, the key characteristics, they have an innate sense of superiority. They innately believe they are better, smarter, and deserve more than the people around them. And over time, they quite often are justified in thinking that because they do get away with more than the people around them get away with, mostly because the people around them, A, don't try and pull the sort of shit that a psychopath will pull because we have a combination of empathy and guilt, which they don't have. And also because psychopaths just have the innate skills to bullshit their way through lots of situations where most of us would get caught out. So they have an innate sense of superiority. They have a very high appetite for risk. They're willing to take enormous risks, predominantly because they are convinced they will succeed because they believe they are superior. They will get away with stuff. And again, the ones that you see as senior leaders of organizations typically have been successful. They have taken a lot of risks. They have gotten away with it. There are psychopaths with a very high IQ who are quite charming, who get away with all this stuff. And then there are the ones that don't. They burn out very early on. But the ones that get away with it tend to have a very high IQ.
With our society at the moment, Cam, there seems to be very little accountability, at least in politics and in business, where companies are failing and yet the CEOs move on and get a nice job at some other company at a similar or better pay scale or level. And the same with our politicians. They're right, perhaps, for downplaying the risk, because if you're looking at the way our society is running at the moment, people seem to just get away with stuff that, I don't know, I don't feel like it was as easy to get away with previously. So maybe that risk isn't there.
Yeah, well, one of the things I explore in the book is what are the symptoms of a psychopathic culture in an organization or in a country? What are the symptoms when there's been enough psychopathy for long enough and the conditions are right that you can bring an entire population along with you, or you can erect the necessary foundations in sort of a business culture with business expectations that it becomes normalized, psychopathic behaviors become normalized and in fact expected. It's like when, you know, if you say that so-and-so politician is corrupt, and people will say, well, that's all politicians are corrupt, you know, particularly if it's a member of their own party. If it's a member of a party they don't like, and they're like, oh, yeah, they're corrupt. Particularly if you talk to Americans, you're talking to an American Democrat, the Republicans are all evil. If you point out corruption in the Democrats, they're like, well, all politicians are corrupt. Come on, at least they're not as bad as that guy, right? It's the normalization of these sorts of psychopathic behaviors that we've seen over decades and decades of capitalist democracies, which I think in particular make it easier for psychopaths to rise. But before I get distracted by that, the other key thing, and the thing that all of the medical literature will point to, is a lack of empathy, or very, very low empathy. Not necessarily zero empathy, but very, very low empathy. Because most of us, if we hurt somebody or a group of people, if we have to, you know, screw over somebody at work so we get the promotion and they don't, or if we have to fire 1,000 people on Christmas Eve so we get a bonus and they'll get laid off, for most of us, we could do that necessarily. Oh, John, Dire Straits is John. Hi, John. Good on you, John. John discovered your podcast through me, so you're welcome. And then he stopped paying for my podcast, so, you know, he's on the outs. And then, John, yeah, I'm kidding, welcome. Kidding, John. Love you long time, John. Where was I going with that? Oh, yes. If most of us can do bad things, we can cheat on our spouse, we can lie about our taxes, we can fire people, we can do all this sorts of stuff, but we feel bad about it. And we lose sleep, we lose weight, we have, you know, stress, we get sick sometimes. When a psychopath does those things, they have the best night's sleep of their life because they feel like they've got hashtag tiger blood and they're a hashtag winner because they're willing to do what the losers aren't willing to do to get ahead and to get more power. And that's the key thing, I think, that differentiates the 99% of us from the 1 to 4% that rank highly on the psychopath test, according to most clinical psychologists and psychiatrists who work in this field.
Now, one of your theories,
a long enough answer to your
one of your theories about organizations becoming psychopathic. You mentioned business, religious, political, but you talk about organizational Darwinianism, where, and you can obviously expand on this, Cam, as I'm sure you will. But it talks about the culture is maintained because if you're not going to fit in with that sort of psychopathic culture, you won't even apply for the job, you won't progress through the organization, and you'll probably leave. So just want to describe how organizations find it really hard to change because the people are sort of weeded out or filtered to match up the organization.
Yeah, this is something that Chomsky and Herman pointed out in Manufacturing Consent back in the early 90s, I think, which was based on the work of a Brisbane boy. But they call it the five filters, the way that organizations filter out troublemakers, basically. But yeah, look, if organizations, if you take whether it's religious or corporate or political, whatever, obviously the first filter is the application process. They will tell you in the job ad what it is, or the seek ad, what they're looking for. And so they're filtering out people who will read that and go, well, that's obviously not me. Then there's another filter, which is the interview process, where obviously they're trying to weed out the people that they don't think are the right cultural fit for the organization. And if it's a psychopathic culture or a broken culture, they're obviously looking for people that will fit within that culture and won't make waves. But people will sneak through that, you know, deliberately or accidentally. They will, or sometimes they'll have certain hiring goals for diversity or something, and people will get through. But then once you're inside of the organization, if you see behaviors going on inside of the organization, and I saw this at Microsoft, that you're not comfortable with ethically or morally, and first of all, you need to know what your ethical and moral framework is, and most of us don't because we've never sat down and gone through that exercise, and I sort of walk people through how maybe to do that in the book, but most of us don't get taught that in life. But if you do feel awkward about something and you don't want to go along with a decision or make a decision, you kind of know that if you don't, somebody else will, and they will get the promotion, they will get the bonus, and their job will be secure. So that quite often people will just go along to get along, as they say. Or if you see somebody else doing something, you have to make this decision, do I speak out about it or not? If you speak out about it inside of the organization, the dominant culture will usually shut you down in a number of ways, either in a very harsh way or in a soft and gentle way, but generally shut you down if you're creating waves. Then you have to make the decision, well, do I, you know, if you see this enough and you just decide I can't be part of this, do you stick around and try and make change? Do you make waves inside of the organization, which, you know, there's a lot of risk to your, both your broader reputation in your industry if you do that, plus obviously your ability to keep the job or get promoted inside of the organization. Or if you just leave, if you quit, then obviously the culture just keeps ticking along. They just, you know, fill that gap with someone else. If you become a whistleblower, if you become a Snowden and you try and Snowden the organization, or you know, the guy who blew the whistle on the ATO, or you know, we have a number of examples in this country in recent years, you know, the organization will come after you and try and destroy your reputation, hit you with massive lawsuits that, as an individual punter, you've got very little ability to defend yourself against. They will try and crush and destroy you. And one of the things I point out in the book, I think you can tell a lot about how healthy the culture of an organization is by the way they deal with whistleblowers and the way they deal with customers, generally speaking. Businesses that treat customers like shit probably have a fairly psychopathic culture. Mm-hmm. Organizations that genuinely care about their customers and go out of their way to make their customers' experiences positive, probably a sign of a healthy culture. And it's the same with the way they treat whistleblowers. Organizations with a healthy culture, if somebody leaves the organization and goes into the meeting and says, hey, listen, I work there and they've got some fundamental problems, ethical problems, moral problems, etc. A healthy organization, you would like to think, would go, wow, that I'm really glad that you told us about that. We're going to bring in an independent external investigations team to go and look at this. We're going to do an inquiry. We would love you to be part of that because, you know, the ethics of our organization is really important to us. And, we, you know, as well as the perception of our organization, let's deal with this in a wholesome manner to make sure that we get a good outcome versus we're going to crush you and destroy you and turn you into sand beneath our boots, which is what most organizations tend to do, of course.
So a psychopathic organization is quite adept at the leadership that percolates to the top. We've gone through this filtering process to be psychopathically in tune with the nature of the organization. So, Cam, question for you. The former Soviet Union, was that a psychopathic organization, you think?
Yeah, I think, I've spent hundreds of hours talking about Stalin on my Cold War show.
I know. So my question is, if it was a psychopathic organization and Gorbachev comes along and basically says, looks around and goes, well, don't like the look and smell of this, I think we call it a day and we move on to a different project, have you got an explanation for that?
Which, in fact, he didn't do. Gorbachev never intended to shut down the Soviet Union. That was never his intention, never his plan. But anyway, your first question, yes, I think particularly under Stalin, I think Stalin had a lot of problems he had to deal with inside of the USSR when he took over. They were facing some massive existential threats. But yes, he does seem to have exhibited classic psychopathic behaviors in his attempts to direct the ship in the direction that he thought it needed to go in order to survive. Hmm. After him, the guys that came after him, probably to lesser extents than Stalin, I think, they were trying to manage the thing they inherited. Of course, when Gorbachev came along and decided to open up, so glasnost and perestroika were definitely things that Gorbachev wanted to do. He didn't want to shut down the Soviet Union or get rid of communism or anything like that. He wanted to make it better. He wanted to improve what they were doing, a little bit like Deng Xiaoping did when Mao died and he took over China.
Yeah. He also sort of pulled back on the sort of authoritarian rule of neighboring countries, though. Is that true? Here's the theory I'm leading to is that Gorbachev got to the top, but nobody actually realized that he wasn't actually like the rest of them in some ways, that he was kind of an aberration. And they'd promoted this guy up thinking he was a psychopath like the rest of them. And once he got there, it was like, hang on a minute, that's not quite what we bargained for. He's a little bit different to what we thought. And that was...
I don't think he would have got there if Stalin was still running the joint, but weakened down over the years. But I think everyone there at the time knew that, you know, they were broke. As a country, they were broke. As a philosophy, it was riddled with holes by, you know, the 80s when Gorbachev came in. So they were looking, for change. Probably they didn't expect him to pull a Gough Whitlam and just, you know, rewrite everything overnight as he did, make some massive existential changes to the country.
Mm. So you've painted a picture where we've got, at least turning back to the West, where we've got in our political, our corporate, our religious organisations, sort of psychopathic controllers in many cases as an explanation of why we're in a mess. And these people are not doing what the rest of the community would like them to do. And the question is, why don't the masses, the people, rise up and revolt, Cam? What's stopping people from saying, hang on a minute, we don't like this. We don't appreciate what you're doing and we want you to stop. Why aren't we up in arms about it and trying to stop it?
Yeah, that's the big question, right? So I think there's a couple of answers to that. I think part of it is we still don't understand psychopaths. You know, I think that the majority of people out there today, when they think psychopath or sociopath, they think serial killer Ted Bundy, or they think Hitler or Stalin or Pol Pot or something like that, dictator, mass murderer, or a, you know, lower level mass murderer like a Ted Bundy. This is pre-Trump. I wrote the book sort of pre-Trump, came out late Trump, but he may have changed the scales on that. But people, you know, in the book I talk about the idea of garden variety psychopaths, not your, you know, it's the vast majority of psychopaths out there, the ones who do the most damage aren't the Hitlers or the Stalins or the Ted Bundys. It's the cardinals and the CEOs and the prime ministers and the people like that who do the vast majority of the damage. But we haven't, you know, the whole idea of psychopaths is only 70 years old. It only really, the early research was being done in the 50s in the US, and it's really only been in the last 20 years that it's started to make its way into the mainstream lexicon that people think about it, but it still hasn't filtered down where we don't look at our manager or our priest or our wife or husband or our next door neighbor or the police chief and say, oh yeah, they're a psychopath. You know, we're not familiar with the psychopath checklist. We're not familiar with the behaviors of a psychopath. So we still are trapped in this medieval view of evil. Oh, so and so did that because Hitler, you know, gassed the Jews because he was evil. Stalin allowed for the Holodomor, one of the famine in the Ukraine because he was evil. We think in terms of evil or bad apples. We don't think about, and this, you know, gets back to my earlier book about free will. We don't yet think about human behavior in terms of biochemical events happening in the brain. that every human action, every thought, every action is the result of neurochemical events, biological events happening in the brain. We haven't yet mainstreamed, normalized a scientific view of human behavior. We still are wrapped up in this homunculus religious view of a soul and a spirit. And even you know, atheists, secular people who listen to the show, I guarantee you 99% of the people watching this right now, listen to your podcast, still believe they have free will. There's absolutely no scientific evidence for free will, never has been, never will be, because it's scientifically improbable, implausible, and impossible. But people still cling to it, even atheists, because they just haven't adopted a fully scientific view of who they are and how they work. And it's the same with psychopathy. So we don't think in terms of psychopaths. And I want us to think about psychopaths in those terms. Look, we're always going to have them. They're just a fact of life, it seems. We need to prepare for them. We need to manage them. And the second part of it is, you know,
just that bit where you said we're always going to have them. I think somebody I know once said,
yeah, I just accept it. I'm not outraged.
It's a common thought, Ken.
You're pointing out that you are, in fact, the inventor of the Ray Harris soundboard, which I had forgotten.
I don't get enough credit for that. Thank you.
I don't get enough credit for inventing podcasting on your podcast, and you don't get enough credit for inventing the Ray Harris soundboard.
Indeed. I had to throw it in. I want to get on to one of your theories. So
So the other reason we don't rise up is because we've had 100 years of propaganda telling us that rising up is bad.
Yes. Right? Yes.
Every revolution in the world, unless it's supported by the West, is a bad revolution. The people should not rise up, because rising up is a thing that terrorists/communists do. Mm. And thirdly, why we don't is because we're fat and happy, most of us in the West. We like, well, yes, okay, psychopaths are running things and climate change and bloody, bloody, blah, and coronavirus fuck-ups and vaccine fuck-ups and all of that kind of stuff. But I've got a big house and a big TV and a couple of cars in the garage, and my kids go to a good school, and I go on vacation. Well, I used to before COVID. Really, who wants to rock the boat when you've got a big middle class? No one wants to rock the boat.
Yeah, yeah. On this sort of area, one of your theories is that capitalism has enabled psychopaths. You said we've always had psychopaths, but there's something about capitalism that brings them more power and makes it easier for them to operate. And I think reading in your book, you mentioned that really in olden days, unless you were a prince or a high priest or somebody, there were very few people with actual power, and most people were scuffling around in the mud, planting some crops and tending to some cattle. And if you were a psychopath, there was a limit to the influence that you could have. And modern capitalism has sort of created a dynamic where psychopaths can flourish where they couldn't previously, and they can do a lot of damage. I'm going to read a quote here. Dear listener, as I'm reading this, you have to imagine who wrote this. And Cam, you're not allowed to answer because you know the answer. It goes on for
even
a bit.
Even before you read it, I know the answer.
That's right. And it goes on for a bit, but because I haven't a chance to say anything, I'll take this opportunity to say something, and you can have a drink. Yeah. So, private capital tends to become concentrated in few hands, partly because of competition among the capitalists and partly because technological development and the increasing division of labor encourage the formation of larger units of production at the expense of smaller ones. The result of these developments is an oligarchy of private capital, the enormous power of which cannot be effectively checked even by democratically organized political society. This is true since the members of legislative bodies are selected by political parties, largely financed or otherwise influenced by private capitalists who, for all practical purposes, separate the electorate from the legislature. The consequence is that the representatives of the people do not in fact sufficiently protect the interests of the underprivileged sections of the population. Moreover, under existing conditions, private capitalists inevitably control directly or indirectly the main sources of information, press, radio, education. It is thus extremely difficult, and indeed in most cases quite impossible, for the individual citizen to come to objective conclusions and to make intelligent use of his political rights. And who do you think said that? And Cam, in his book, gives possibilities: Che Guevara, Fidel Castro, Vladimir Lenin, Noam Chomsky. I would have put Chomsky as a good one for that. Julian Assange. And the answer was none of the above. It was, in fact, Albert Einstein. So there you go, dear listener. The sort of increased power of the oligarchy, their control of the political process, and the difficulty for just the ordinary citizen to make intelligent use of his political rights, summed up by Albert Einstein. Good quote to find, Cam.
Yeah, there's, if you haven't read Einstein's writings on social and philosophical and political issues, it's well worth reading. He was very articulate and very passionate about those things, but people tend to forget or just don't pay attention to that aspect of Einstein. And he was writing that, I think, in the 50s. You know, obviously it's even worse now. And so to get back to the reason why I think capitalism has made it easier, you articulated it well. It's about social mobility, right? So if you go back a couple of hundred years ago, if you were born in a village somewhere, whether it was the US or Europe or wherever, and you were a psychopath, you were one of this 1, 2, 3, 4% that was born a psychopath, psychopathic tendencies. Yeah, like you could maybe end up being the tyrant of your little village. Maybe if you're in Renaissance Italy, you would have ended up as a mercenary. You could have, you know, and there's some instances like Ludovico Sforza's father, who made himself the Duke of Milan. He was a mercenary for hire to various popes and leaders of Florence, like the Medici, until he was rich enough and he could go and build a big enough mercenary army and take Milan and make himself the Duke of Milan. But that didn't happen very often. You know, there were instances of that. But really, if you were a psychopath, you either got knifed in the back by the people in your village because you were just a... I don't know if I can swear. If I can't swear freely, I can't articulate myself.
Do what you feel comfortable with.
Okay, if you're a complete cunt, you get knifed by somebody in your village eventually, right? Or if you survived, you would rise up and you'd be a mini tyrant. But it was very difficult to become, you know, a baron or a king or a bishop even. You know, they had a fair amount of wealth and power. Then along comes modern capitalism, particularly American-style capitalism. It doesn't matter where you're born in America or Australia or the UK or most places of the world today. It doesn't matter what little village you're born. If you're a psychopath, you can, you know, get enough money to get on a bus or get on a train and go to the big smoke. And then you get to the big smoke and you work your way up. You know, you Wolf of Wall Street it. You start off in the mail room and you work your way up. You stab people in the back and you climb the ladder.
Well, there are these organizations that will encourage psychotic behavior, psychopathic behavior. So in the village where you're sharing resources to some extent and you're sort of monitoring the commons and whatnot, that sort of behavior is going to be looked down upon, whereas in some of these sort of organizations that have been created in capital, that sort of behavior suddenly becomes valuable, whereas before it wasn't. It's encouraged. The organizations that are there. Yeah.
Psychopathic behavior in the West now is encouraged and rewarded as long as you don't go too far or get caught out. And that happens. You have the Enrons. The guys, and I talk about Enron, I got a whole chapter on Enron in the book. These guys were fated by the business media, the business establishment, the banking industry, politicians in the US. Everyone loved Enron until it turned out it was a complete house of cards and it collapsed. But, you know, you look at the transcripts of some of the conferences between the CFO of Enron and the financial journalists before they collapsed, where journalists were asking questions about their financial reporting and the CFO was just literally abusing them and calling them names on the call just as an arrogant piece of shit that he was. Like, they were just super, super arrogant psychopaths. But that kind of behavior tends to be, if you're willing to make the hard decision for the sake of profit, then organizations of all colors will snatch you up. And it's left and right. It's not just Republicans. It's not just the Liberal Party. It's the Labor Party. You know, the plenty of people who worked with Kevin Rudd after he left office the first time came out and said he's a psychopath, complete psychopath. It's all about him, right? It's not the left or right thing, because psychopaths don't have an ideology. Their only ideology is me. And they will look for the gaps, look for the holes where they think they can get in, where they have a foot in the door, and they will get in, they will work their way up through. And, you know, classic Donald Trump supposedly was a Democrat 25 years ago. Then he just switched, became a Republican, because he doesn't have an ideology outside of me, right? Where can I, you know, get more wealth and power? That's the only thing that psychopaths care about. So they're left, right, priests, CEOs, they come in all flavors, all colors, but they do tend to be white men. I mean, at the end of the day, the majority of them appear to be white men.
Cam, I want to move on to...
Congratulations, white man.
I want to move on to concepts around messaging and propaganda. So this is an important part of the whole idea, isn't it? So just reading a couple of excerpts from your book here. As they have to do it, the elite, the psychopaths, know that if we wanted to, the public could start a revolution and cripple the economic system that keeps them on top at any time. To prevent that, we need to be kept ignorant of the relevant facts, overworked, poor, heavily in debt, and distracted. So, and all of that takes systematic brainwashing. And another part here, you say, actually, you're quoting Alex Carey in this part, an Australian social psychologist. Is he the guy to do with Noam Chomsky? Is that the same guy?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So, Carey wrote a book and then died very young. He wrote this book in the 80s, about 86, on this, and then he died. And Chomsky and Herman were friends of his, and they picked up his work and fleshed it out into Manufacturing Consent. And they give him credit in the foreword of the book as being the progenitor of these ideas. He's from Brisbane.
Yeah, there you go. So a couple of quotes from this Alex Carey. The 20th century has been characterized by three developments of great political importance: the growth of democracy, the growth of corporate power, and the growth of corporate propaganda as a means of protecting corporate power against democracy. I like that. And then this other one, corporate propaganda has two main objectives: to identify the free enterprise system in popular consciousness with every cherished value, and to identify interventionist governments and strong unions, the only agencies capable of checking the complete domination of society by the corporations, of identifying them with tyranny, oppression, and even subversion. Cam, would you like to wax on about propaganda and how that's working in our society for a good 5 minutes while I have a drink? Thanks.
Yeah, no, only five? Yeah, well, you know, Chomsky's got a great saying where he says, when most people think, I'm paraphrasing, of course, but when most people think of propaganda, they think of, you know, third world dictator style propaganda with the picture of the Führer or the dictator up on the wall. And, you know, it's very overt. It's very heavy handed. Whereas propaganda in the West is much more sophisticated. And Chomsky actually, I think, coined the phrase for a propaganda. So it doesn't tell you necessarily what to think, but it creates a small window, you know, what we now call the Overton window in some ways, about what's acceptable to think about, right? So if you read, you know, the mainstream media on many issues, you'll see that there's a very limited set of parameters for what's acceptable discourse. And anything outside of that is either scorned or ignored or just given very little time, very little coverage. So, you know, if you talk about,
I'll just interrupt about this Overton window. So, because there's a bit here in your book, this is analysis from Media Matters. So cable news channels used variations of the label far left or extreme in discussions about Democrats, progressives, and their policy ideas, over six times more often than they used variations of the label far right or extreme while talking about their conservative counterparts. So over a four-week period...
This would be in the US.
Yes. Over a four-week period, CNN, MSNBC and Fox News discussed extremism on the left or right a total of 547 times, which was 86% of the instances, frame the American political left as extreme. So that's part of that sort of propaganda where when talking about the left, it was the extreme left in 86% of cases, and very rarely was it the extreme right, even though if you look at American policy and politics compared to the rest of the world, they're way over on the right, and the their right is right of Genghis Khan, and their left is still on the right of Genghis Khan, isn't it? So
Bernie Sanders is called the extreme left over there. Here he'd be in the Liberal Party. You know, he's like so mainstream for, you know, most of us. You know, he just wants healthcare. So yeah, look, there is a limited, like the other example I was going to use is that communism. When we're talking about, you know, our socioeconomic system here in Australia and the mainstream media and, you know, what's right and what's wrong, there's never any discussion of socialism or communism in the mainstream media. It just isn't allowed to be a topic of discussion. It just never comes up. Well, maybe we should think it. No, you can't even have an intelligent conversation about it. It's just verboten. You're not allowed to go there. So, yeah, the propaganda has been very, very heavy. And, you know, in my Cold War podcast series, we've gone back and looked at, in the United States, what happened in the 30s during, you know, when FDR came in. So Roosevelt came in, obviously the New Deal, even though he was a blue blood aristocrat, he realized that there needed to be some fairly fundamental changes to the way that the US economy worked. There needed to be a welfare system. He comes in a couple of years into the Great Depression. In fact, he said to the Wall Street bankers several times, listen, I'm your best friend, because if I don't do this, the guys with the pitchforks and the torches are going to do this like they did in Moscow, right? So I'm your first, last, and best line of defense against the great unwashed, because communism was becoming increasingly popular in the US at the time, as it was right around the world during the 30s. But the business leaders were dead against any sort of changes happening. No government regulation, no allowances for unions, no wealth sharing, all that kind of stuff. And so they figured out eventually, it took them a couple of decades, it wasn't until the 50s that they really got good at this. They started aligning themselves with evangelical pastors. And their selling point was, listen, if America goes communist, if the people get what they want and it becomes a communist country, communists don't like religion. So religion goes. So if it becomes communist, you're gone, right? Yeah. Even though before that, in Roosevelt's time, and actually Roosevelt himself was a member of a Christian church that was pro-socialist. It was a socialist religious organization that was arguing for more welfare and distribution of the wealth and, you know, curbing the power of businesses and that kind of things. Anyway, so they started aligning themselves with the priests, and the priests that got on board with this, not all priests did initially, but the priests that got on board got a shit ton of money from business leaders in the US. They could use that money to build massive churches with, you know, big organs and big choirs and big car parks and all of the business elite, all of the bosses. First guy who did it was a guy in Los Angeles. All of the elite of Los Angeles went to this guy's church. Now, their employees were like, well, the boss is going to that church, so I should go to that church. So all of the church attendants left all these little churches that didn't get on board with the pro-capitalist program and went to the big capitalist churches. So they reinforced in the minds of Americans that America means Christianity. Christianity means America. You know, Jesus, you know, his last dying wish was to create America, and capitalism is the last thing he said on the cross. Didn't make it to the Bible, but it was really, you know, I bless America.
And wealth, so wealth became associated with godliness. So God was favoring you if you were wealthy. It was a sign.
Prosperity doctrine, all that kind of stuff, yeah. And if you're not doing well, God's got a plan for you. You know, that's okay. You know, there's a plan for you, which goes right back to St. Paul, actually.
Or perhaps you hadn't been godly enough and there must have been something you've been doing. Yes.
Exactly.
Wrong.
And the Mormons are a big part of this too. You know, the Mormons, you know, their whole shtick is we're the richest, best church in America because God loves us the most, right? We're the most American religion because God loves us the most.
What would you know about Mormons?
I've been married to two ex-Mormons in my life. I know it well. So anyway, so the propaganda aligning a certain kind of worldview has been very heavily invested in the United States. And because the United States after World War II took over global culture, particularly in the West, it's trickled down into all of our countries. Now, in Australia, you know, Menzies tried to ban the Communist Party. I mean, we had just as much problem in this country with outlawing thought. You weren't allowed to be a communist in this country. He had two cracks at outlawing it. The Supreme Court threw it out both times, or whatever we call it here. The High Court threw it out both times. But it eventually got sort of wound down. But he, you know, he spent decades trying to get rid of any sign of communism in this country, of course.
Well there's a reincarnation of that McCarthyism with the current China, you know, anti-China propaganda is just
it started with Russiagate in the US. You know, Putin, you know, Trump was Putin's bitch, and all of, you know, I did many, many shows on that on the Bullshit Filter over the years that Trump was in power. Like this incredible media storm about, you know, Russiagate, backed up by nothing, nada, zip. Mm. They had nothing. And yet even the Mueller report eventually came out and said, I can find no evidence of collusion. But try telling that to Democrats today, like 18 months later after the Mueller report came out, they still believe that Trump colluded with Putin to win the 2016 election. There's just no getting through because there was so much propaganda about that from the mainstream media and the Democrats over there. And now, yes, now all of a sudden it's pivoted to China. China's the great evil. China's going to come and eat your babies. China's...
Cam, I saw a statistic which was about they surveyed countries about their fear of whether they would be invaded by China. And Australia's fear of being invaded by China was higher than Taiwan.
Our fear of China was higher than Taiwan's fear of China, our fear of being invaded by Taiwan.
His fear of being invaded by China.
By the way, technically speaking, Taiwan is part of China. Yes. I just want to say that. Mao Zedong wanted me to just point out that he never gifted Taiwan to the Kuomintang. They stole it, and he just had other things to do at the time. But he's coming for it. The ghost of Mao is coming for it.
Noted. Thank you, Cam.
Yeah. It's irrational because we've just had Formosa. Thank you, Restream. I do mean Formosa. Yeah. It's original land. Yeah. Look, we've just been under this barrage of anti-Chinese media coverage in the last couple of years. It's astounding. And if you've studied McCarthyism and you've studied the Red Scare, like I've been doing for the last few years for the Cold War show, it's just completely obvious what's going on. It's just a replay of that in the most blatant form, and people just fall for it again, as they always do, because we're kept busy and poor and broke. Who has time, apart from us jobless, unemployed podcasters? Who don't have anything else to do than read books, you know, and embarrassingly, as my listeners know, I get all of my knowledge from books. No one else gets the luxury to do that. They're too busy working real jobs to put food on the table and a big house and a big TV and a couple of vacations a year and a couple of nice cars in the driveway, right?
Yeah.
Podcasters generally, I know you're the exception, but most of us don't have those things either.
That's right. Don't mention the pizza oven. One of the sort of key parts in that, Cam, are these think tanks, particularly when it comes to China and defense issues. And when you're looking at if somebody comes out and beats up what a threat China is to our sovereignty and our trade routes, you know, our trade routes with China, ironically, invariably these people are part of some think tank. It doesn't matter if it's ABC or Channel 7 or Murdoch Press or whatever, they'll trot out these experts who will be, you know, with some think tank, and people are under the impression that these think tanks are neutral entities, that they're actually sitting there thinking. And they're all, of course, just funded by typically the Defence Force contractors. And, of course, they're going to come out with these lines. So there's just not enough recognition of of the insidious role of these think tanks in a lot of this stuff? Because they get reported in the media that you'd kind of like to trust, like the ABC or groups like that.
Yeah, I've got a whole chapter or two in the book about lobby groups, front groups, experts. It's bad here. It's worse in the US. You know, you will see all of the media channels will trot out their former, you know, their military experts that are former Pentagon or CIA, or if it's local domestic issues, FBI people. They're on, you know, they're part of the establishment. They're on the payroll. I think the front groups, which are the think tanks, usually are funded by a whole variety of nefarious sources. That, again, unless you're a podcaster and you have the ability to go and actually go, well, who the fuck is this? And you look it up and you spend an hour drilling down into it, which your average punter isn't going to do. You don't realize that these people are on the payroll. Yes, but the media, oh, we've got 30 seconds. We need to fill quick. Who do we have? And, you know, obviously these organizations are always putting their people forwards as available experts to be talking heads when you need one on TV, and they're going to trot out the establishment's narrative on cue, and no one's going to question it because we don't even have any journalists anymore in this country. I see Rupert's laying off more people this week. It's been trimmed to the bone. Journalists have written their own epitaph over the last 30 years as they've let this happen. They've become basically PR hacks for big corporations and not question it while they were playing violin on the Titanic while it was going down, and all of a sudden they're below the waterline. They're going, oh, this isn't right. What's going on? What's happening to my job? All of a sudden they give a shit when it's their jobs that are affected. But you know, for the last 20 years, while they've let the mainstream media just obliterate any sense of genuine independent journalism and keeping the bastards honest, they just looked the other way, took the paycheck and shut up because of the psychopathic cultures inside of our media organizations. See what I did there? That was a Larry David. I brought it full loop back to psychopathic cultures.
And the way your sort of tone of your voice dropped off right at the end, indicating the end of your spiel and for me to come in. You're a real pro,
masterful,
Cam.
Masterful, right?
So, Cam, part of all this then is, where do we get our information from that we can perhaps trust more than other information? And I see in your book that you gave a little link to your own website, CameronRiley.com/news-sources/. You've got a list there of some independent investigative journalists who you kind of trust to some extent. So the sorts of groups you've got there, investigative journalism, you've got International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, Seymour Hersh, Matt Taibbi, Strategic Culture Foundation, Dancers with Bears, Alan McLeod. So I recognise some of those names. US News, you've got Noam Chomsky, Chris Hedges, Jimmy Dore. Australian, you've got Caitlin Johnston. Middle East, Robert Fisk, sadly deceased. A couple of Reddit areas. In podcasts, you've listed Background Briefing with Ian Masters, Useful Idiots with Matt Taibbi, Moderate Rebels. There's a glaring omission in the podcast list, Cam. I think I've mentioned this before.
I've checked the bank account, Trev. I didn't see the deposit. So there's a limit to, you know, my ethics in independent journalism. No, yeah. I will. I can see the reason you have me on now was just to fix that up. It's all become clear. Yeah, look, I think, you know, I bang on a lot in the Bullshit Filter podcast about epistemology and heuristics. You know, I'm gearing up to do another show, big long show on current state of COVID conspiracy theories in a couple of weeks. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we can't all be experts on everything. I can't even be an expert on one, let alone everything. So we need to have some kind of philosophy for where we're going to get our information from. And I think it starts with, you know, kind of layman's epistemology. Like, how do we know what's true for us individually? Where do I get truth? How do I think truth is derived? Where does truth come from? How do I know what's true? And so for me, when it comes to looking at contemporary news issues, you know, I'm trying to go back to the people that are qualified experts in their domain. We're talking about COVID, it's epidemiologists or people that represent the mainstream consensus view for, you know, an active discipline. They actually know what they're talking about. then there can be a lot of people in that sense, a lot of people with the training and the qualifications. So then it comes down to my heuristics, like in terms of my rule of thumb, who do I turn to for this particular subject matter? And why do I turn to that person or that group? So it, for me, it would have to be that they have a track record in you know, being honest, having a high level of integrity, you know, their views coinciding with what seems to be the mainstream scientific view or the view of the best thinkers in this space, as opposed to, because there's a fringe view on everything, so everyone can find an expert these days. You have to try and figure out, who do I trust and why do I trust that person? So if you come to me, if I give you a point of view on a subject and you say, well, where did you get it from? I'll tell you what my source is. And then if you give me an opposing view, I'll say, well, you know, and I often do this when I get people on to debate me on our podcast, and they go, well, what's your source? And if you can't give me a credible source for where you're getting your data or your analysis of data from, then the conversation's over. It's meaningless. If you don't have a credible source, and if you can't tell me why you trust that source and why you think that source is credible, I'm not going to waste my time talking to you because you're a flake, right? Yeah, I don't give a shit what your opinion is. If you can't back it up with data or analysis of data from a credible source and tell me why that source is credible, I'm not interested. Right? You're just another dickhead with an opinion. So it's important that we think about these sorts of things and we compile a list of sources. And, you know, I encourage people to check out my list, share your lists with me and tell me why you like your sources. And let's come up with a list of sources that we think are worth paying attention to.
Did you find, this one you're doing on COVID, did you find with COVID it was a little bit strange or disappointing or inexplicable, just some of the people who on their face had good qualifications as epidemiologists who were coming out with some quite crazy theories that seemed to be quite contrary to the general community of fellow experts? Like, I just sort of noticed myself in investigating these that you would see this name say something. Maybe it was that the Great Barrington Declaration or whatever, and I think one or two of the authors of that, on the face of it, seem to have, you know, a career as an epidemiologist, and then they've come out with these statements, and you think, well, that's odd. I can, you know, I get it when a YouTuber with no experience in epidemiology, who's a self-described problem solver, has a million views and says something and you say, well, okay, you don't have any expertise. But I just found with COVID, did you find that at all in your research, that you had some genuine experts and you scratched your head as to why they had flipped compared to the rest of their peers?
Well, so then you need to ask the question, why? What's going on there? Mm. You need to have some sort of an answer to that question. If you have people that are on paper qualified experts in their profession. And, you know, with that document, the last time I looked at it, which was a while back, but, you know, a good percentage of the people who signed the document had, you know, were not practicing active epidemiologists. They were geologists Yes. expressing an opinion on COVID Mm. and that kind of stuff. But, you know, the people that are eminently qualified, you have to ask yourself, well, why? Why do they have an opposing view? And like people, you know, and I'm the first person to say that, you know, science progresses through once fringe voices that then work their way into the mainstream. So there's nothing inherently wrong with fringe contrarian voices. That's how science mm-hmm. works. We all understand, hopefully, those of us that pay attention understand that that's how science works. But the way that science works is that those fringe contrarian voices need to make their case successfully to the consensus mainstream of scientists before the rest of us should accept it as being the best current version of the truth. The fact that a fringe person says it is true doesn't necessarily mean that it's wrong, but it also doesn't necessarily mean that it's true. So how do you tell what is most likely to be true? It's when you have the consensus. So yes, you'll get these documents where there will be a handful, you know, from the total global number of actively practicing epidemiologists, the ones that are signing documents like that is the vast minority of them. So yeah, there's still a fringe voice, and science at the end of the day, whether whack job conspiracy theorists or not like this, is built around consensus, like my film. I keep telling people, I don't care if you don't like what I said about how the Bible was written in my film, and I don't care if you've got some guy with a PhD in New Testament studies who disagrees with it. The view that we expressed in the film was the mainstream view of New Testament, PhD level New Testament scholars. That's not necessarily meaning that they're right. It's the mainstream view of the consensus. I don't give a fuck if you've got a fringe voice who says they're wrong. Congratulations. But that doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what a fringe guy says. It's the same with COVID science.
What's your any science? You've got a catchphrase. Is it qui bono? Qui bono? What's the phrase you use? What's the Latin? Come on, help me out. As the Advocatus Diaboli, I need help with my of the Nous Temple of Satan. Qui bono. Yeah.
Qui bono. It's from, Cicero used it, but Cicero got it from somewhere else. But yeah. It means who benefits? When he was when he was working as a lawyer, he would often ask the question, who benefits from this situation? Follow the money.
You know? Yes. Yeah. So I know when I'm looking at articles about these things, the first thing I do, you know, if we were going to do something on COVID or whatever topic we're looking at, is before even reading the article, I would say, well, where is it coming from? What's the publisher? And then secondly, who is this journalist who's writing this? Who's this person? What's their story? And then I would begin actually reading the article if the headline has got me in with some clickbait or something. But and trying to work out. Yes. And just a humble podcaster.
You can take the time to think about these things.
Yes.
But Joe Blow, no.
Exactly.
He's going to read the headline, if that, and move on, you know.
Yes. Yeah.
Listen to Alan Jones and move on.
Yeah. Now, just finishing up with your book, Cam, because I know you're a busy man and you've got things to get to. So with the psychopaths and the problems they're causing and their infiltration into our powerful organisations, and it's very difficult for us to do anything about it because we're subjected to propaganda, so it's hard for the average Joe to even know what's going on. And as I was reading the book, you're painting a grim picture, and I kept thinking to myself, gee, I can't wait for the ending where there's a neat little package of a solution here to that wraps it all up and goes, ta-da, here's all we have to do to fix things. And unfortunately, there really wasn't one, Cam. And
yes, there was. I took a lot of time to write that last chapter, Trevor.
No, well, correct me if I'm wrong, but this is what I got from it, which was, what can we do? It would be basically get our shit together so we've got time to be informed by reliable sources so that we can work out whether we're being lied to or bullshitted to. It was kind of
Of it. Did you read the whole chapter? I think you just did you get the velvet glove to read this for you from Cairns or wherever the fuck he is these days? The 12th man. Did the 12th man do this for you?
I read the whole thing. It's got highlights all through it.
No, look, the last chapter, what do we do about it? The simple version is line up all the psychopaths and shoot them. But, the easier version is, there's a couple of things. Number one, I think we all need to do our own analysis on our own ethics, morals, and values. We need to understand what we're willing to participate in and what we're not willing to participate in, because if you aren't clear on that, it's very easy to go along with the flow and be part of the problem, not part of the solution. We also do need to think carefully about the sort of stuff that we put in our brain and the news sources that we pay attention to and why we pay attention to them. And, as I posted on Facebook today, I think, the podcast that you listen to is very important. And, what the world really is lacking, I think, at the moment are more podcasts by celebrities where they interview other celebrities about how great it is being a celebrity. I don't think there's enough of those out there right now. I think COVID.
Like this one.
are we celebrities? Dire Straits, no, I have not done an audio version of the book because I'm not allowed to. Because I signed a deal with my publisher where they have the rights to produce the audiobook and not me. And they sold that on to someone else who hasn't done it because of COVID and whatever. So there you go. I can't even do it if I wanted to. I'm legally not allowed to do an audiobook of my own book, even though I'm a podcaster and I talk for a living.
You should have seen a lawyer about that.
Yeah, I should have. Yeah, well, I signed it. I signed the contract, you know. What are you going to do? But the main all of this that I took a lot of time to think about, for apparently pointlessly, when writing the book, Trevor, is that inside of our organizations, we need to figure out who the psychopaths are and we need to ring fence the psychopaths. Now, being psychopaths isn't necessarily a bad thing. You know, I think psychopaths have qualities. You know, you could argue that Steve Jobs was a psychopath, and I know not everybody is a fan of Steve Jobs, but the flip side is I am. You know, I love my iPad. I love my iPhone. I love my AirPods. I love my MacBook, and I have Steve Jobs to thank for all of those things. Now, Steve also did some really shitty stuff in his lifetime, if you've read Walter Isaacson's biography on him or seen many of the films that have come out or whatever.
You've also got the US military to thank as well. Like, you know, there was that book about so many of the inventions found in the iPhone are actually out of public institutions. That,
what do you mean there was that book? That was my fucking book. I talk about that in my book, that all of these inventions get funded by public money and then end up in private, patents end up in private hands and private, well, anyway. Fuck me. You didn't really read the book, did you?
I was thinking of that Mariana Maruso lady. She wrote a book. I bet the whole thing was about that.
So, yeah, okay. Yeah. Like Mariana Trench lady, never heard of her. So yeah. Anyway, yeah, Chomsky's been talking about that for decades. So we need to understand who the – so I want everybody – easy for me to say because I don't have a job, but everyone that has a job, whether you're in a business or politics or religion or whatever – create a movement inside of the organization. Don't do it by yourself because you'll get knifed. Create a movement. Get 20 people, 30 people, 50 people. Give them my book. Buy 50 copies of my book with corporate funds and hand it out. Create a psychopath committee. You don't have to call it that, but create a committee in your organization to try and get all, particularly management, to sit psychopath tests. Everyone of a certain level inside of an organization should have to sit a psychopath test so we know who the psychopaths are. Now,
Do they work? I'm a bit skeptical about psychopath tests.
I was going to get there. Everyone will say, well, psychopaths will just lie. No, they won't lie on a psychopath test, usually, unless they really think something is hinging on this, because they don't give a fuck what you think about who they are. They're proud of who they are. They're a winner and you're a loser, and they don't give a shit what your little form says they are, because they're a winner and they're in control and they're in power and they're going to win. Regardless of what your little form says, they're going to win. That's what they think and they don't care. Secondly, they're proud of it. Thirdly, you know, well, that's it. It's really only the two things. They're proud of who they are. If they think they might lose their job, which they probably don't if they're a senior manager in an organization, we need to figure out who they are. And ideally this should be done, you know, during the hiring process, but obviously it's too late in all these instances now. We need to figure out, and then we need to ring fence them. Now, by ring fence them, I just mean it could be as simple as having, if you have a senior manager who ranks highly on the psychopath test, you have a committee of people who are not psychopaths, we know this because they did the psychopath test, who get to evaluate the decisions that the manager is making against an ethical framework. That's all. So they can continue to make decisions and continue to have power. We're just trying to avoid them making decisions that are psychopathic. Let them make all the good decisions in the world. Just stop them from making
So an extra layer of management over their decision-making to filter out the really bad stuff they might do.
Yeah. Right. Like a regulatory committee, a governance committee that just makes sure that they're not doing heinous shit.
Okay. Because it's too hard to get rid of these people? Because I would have thought the answer was let's all get together and try and get rid of this person. Not so much?
No, that's because you're, you know, Church of Satan guy, you think satanic. Yeah, no, as I said, I don't necessarily think that would be a good thing. I think psychopaths particularly have qualities, well, have particular qualities, I mean, that could be beneficial. You know, if I go back and I look at Julius Caesar or Alexander or Napoleon or Stalin you name it, Jobs, Gates, I saw somebody earlier in the comment section, Barmer. Yeah, I worked for Barmer. Yeah, Barmer, definitely. You know, these guys have strengths that we want to, you know, it's Atlas Shrugged. It's Ayn Rand, Atlas Shrugged, right? These guys have strengths that society might need to drag us forwards, to make progress. Maybe it was only Steve Jobs that could come out with the iPhone and the, you know, the iPod. Look at this. How beautiful is that, man? Like 2004 model iPod, whatever. It doesn't work, sadly, but it kind of does if I charge it. Maybe you just can't, you can't get a charger like that anymore, you know? Anyway, but we just want to, we want to enable them to make the good decisions but stop them from making the bad decisions. And to reply to Dire Straits, who said, I talk about Chomsky like he's the Messiah. No, he's just the world's leading intellectual and has been, you know, since I interviewed him in 2005 on G'day World. He, I think the day or earlier, he'd been called by The Economist the world's leading intellectual. And then I had to interview him the next day, so that wasn't stressful. But, you know, I think Chomsky is a very, very intelligent guy who spent his entire life thinking about two things: the way America's political system works predominantly, and, you know, where, you know, our foundations of speech come from.
You know? Can you think of a good example of a psychopath being dealt with well in an organization, sort of either curtailed and reined in, or is there any public well-known example of that at all?
Yeah, well, I'll go back to Steve Jobs. So, you know, you go back to the late 80s when Steve was kicked out of Apple by the board because he was, they thought, a danger to the business that he co-founded. They removed him from the organization. And then the organization struggled for, you know, the next, whatever, 13 years, 11 years, I think. Then he came back and he was a very different guy when he came back. He a lot more time and a lot of self-reflection, I think. Possibly still a psychopath to work for, difficult guy to work for, but he seems to have got it right. You know, I watched a clip of him today, actually, on YouTube or something, from one of his early Macworlds or keynotes, you know, after he came back, and somebody got up in the audience and was criticizing some decisions that he made about a lot of the products he was getting rid of. And he said, look, you know, one of the things that I think makes great businesses great is that they are focused on customers first. They think about how can we make customers' lives better, and then they go do that, as opposed to sitting around with a bunch of engineers saying, what kind of technology can we build, then building it, then trying to figure out how to sell it to people, which is what Apple has been doing for the last 10 years. And what we're going to do from now on is we're going to put the customer first for at the center of everything that we do. Now, go into an Apple store today and tell them that your AirPods have stopped charging properly or that your iPhone battery's got a problem and see how long it takes them to replace it and give you a brand new pair, and tell me that that message didn't make its way into the DNA of the organization, right? He's been dead for 10 years, and that is still very obviously at the center of their business culture. I mean, I can't tell you how many times I've still got an iPhone 7 because every time I try and take it back to Apple to get a new one, they just give me a new one and go, oh, here you go. It's, yeah, right. Take this one. I'm like, oh, shit. I was hoping you would give me an excuse to upgrade. And they go, no, just take this one. It's fine. Don't worry about it. So, yeah, look, I think that was an example. You know, Whatley the Wizard says Julius Caesar. I think Julius Caesar wasn't the psychopath. It was Brutus and Cassius who assassinated him, who were the psychopaths in that particular instance. But don't get me started on that. I can't think of many other examples. I mean, there's plenty of examples of the ones like somebody mentioned before, Elizabeth Thanos or whatever her name was from the blood startup that got shot down in flames. There's lots of examples of psychopaths burning out and failing. Mm-hmm. But in terms of curbing their worst behaviors and enabling to do good, I'm not exactly sure I have any great. I didn't come up with any for the book. No.
Right.
Do you have any?
And if you can't get rid of a psychopath, your boss is a psychopath and you're stuck there, just move on. If you can't get rid of him, or if there were not going to be any overseeing of the decisions, then get away from them. Would that be, find another job if you can? Just stop beating your head against a brick wall, or they're just too dangerous to hang around?
Well, you know, that's what happened to me at Microsoft. I resigned because my boss was a psychopath, and I tried all of the legitimate internal mechanisms for dealing with that and just got nowhere. So I ended up getting a big, bad industrial relations lawyer to come and relieve me of the of my obligations to the organization. But, you know, when you do that, you're just leaving the problem there. Like, if you can do something about it, I strongly urge people to, as again, I said before, it's easy for me because I am my own boss and I'm the only psychopath that I have to worry about on a day-to-day basis was Ray. But me and, you know, Ray.
And Fox, like, surely.
Oh, don't get me started. That's a future problem. And, you know, my elder boys, sure, one of them's a narcissist. I'm not sure he's a psychopath, but definitely a narcissist.
All right, Cam. Okay, so we'll wind it up, Cam.
Can I get a plug for the film in while I'm in?
Well, that's what I was going to say. Let's devote the next 5 or 10 minutes to plugs because half the audience in the chat room were ex-bullshit filter sort of people who have come across and have now joined me. So this is my attempt to sort of send them back in your direction as well. So, so for the people who don't know you, Cam, let's start with podcasts. You've got a number of history podcasts and you've got the Bullshit Filter. And so if they go to the podcastnetwork.com, then they will see a list there. And
go to CameronRiley.com. But yeah, Podcast Network for all the podcasts. And we do a show, a regular show on ancient Rome. We started with Julius Caesar. We're up to Nero at the moment. It's deep dive stuff. We did a series on Alexander the Great, which went for 150 episodes or something. We're doing a very long series on the Cold War. We're currently in the middle of the Korean War on that. Very deep, deep dive sort of a series. We do a series on the Renaissance. We're currently episode 16 on Leonardo da Vinci, but that's hundreds of episodes. We're into the Renaissance. The Bullshit Filter, where I just talk about whatever's on my mind at any given month. Well, actually, Sean Hadrill says, Psychopath Committee sounds like McCarthyism or Witch Hunting 2.2. Well, actually, it is. But yeah, we need to, this is the, if I'm right, this is the great threat to civilization, psychopaths. So we, again, but I'm not saying that we're blackballing them like McCarthy tried to do. We're not trying to get them fired. As I keep saying, they have good positive qualities. We want to retain the positive qualities, just limit their ability to do harm, really. And so then, yeah, they're the podcast most. I also do QAV, right, my investing podcast with Tony Kynaston, which we do every week, where we teach people how to invest like Warren Buffett, basically. Yeah, and then I've got the film that came out and died quickly just prior to COVID. We had a sold-out screening in Melbourne. A sold-out screening in Sydney, but only half the people turned up because Sydney was half in lockdown on the night it happened. And then the Brisbane screening, which I know you were coming to, didn't happen because the cinemas shut down the day that the screening was to be held at the Barracks in March of last year. So it's Marketing the Messiah. You can see it. You can find it on YouTube. You can find it on Amazon Prime. You can find it on the website, marketingthemessiah.com. But I went out and I interviewed 12 experts on early Christianity. Most of them have a PhD in New Testament studies or biblical studies or ancient history or something like that. And I was really just trying to get them to help articulate the mainstream consensus view on how Christianity got started, right? Who was there? Who did it? What was the progression of events that went from Jesus through to the New Testament being written, basically, sort of capped it with the writing of the Gospels. Didn't go right through to, you know, the Constantine and Theodosius and all of those sorts of things, which I have done in detail in my Renaissance series, because you can't understand the Renaissance without understanding the Dark Ages, and you can't understanding.
This is the Renaissance series that started in about 100 AD, is that right? Is it?
270 CE, with the persecutions of Diocletian. You can't understand the Dark Ages without understanding the rise of Christianity, et cetera, et cetera. So, yeah, but the film is a comedic, like a slightly humorous, depending on who you ask. If you go to the reviews on Amazon Prime, half the audience give it 5 stars and think it's the other half are Christians and give it 1 star and saying it's boring and terrible and factually incorrect and I'm a complete tool. So there's nothing like being divisive. But it was I tried to do a fair, balanced, nice, film, Marketing the Messiah. Sean, there's a poster behind me. I don't know if you can see that. The screen's been like, that's the, no, yeah.
I'll put a link in the show notes.
All right, look at that. Yeah, there's the poster.
Yeah, Marketing the Messiah. Yeah, that's it.
Yeah. I tried to be fair and nice. I tried not to be too offensive or nasty or mean. So half the scholars in the film are Christians. Half of them are probably atheists, I think. I mean, I didn't really ask people, but I think they were half and half. I tried to make it half and half. And they're all, there's no theologians. There's no rabid atheists. It's all, well, 11 out of the 12 scholars are PhD level scholars. And then there's David Fitzgerald, who's written a bunch of books on early Christianity. And I like Dave, and I wanted him on to sort of, you know, be my mouthpiece really in the thing. Because originally when I shot it, I didn't think I would be on camera much. Thought it would just be the scholars. But then in the editing room, it was obvious that somebody needed to string it together. And there's some, you know, amusing, slightly offensive animations in there to helping tell the story, South Park-y style stuff. So yeah, that's the film. I'm quite proud of how it turned out.
We should do a Brisbane screening at some point, Cam. Like, why not? No?
Yeah. Well,
too hard to do.
Right. I mean, it's too hard to fucking do anything in COVID, right? It's,
right. It would just probably and bring
with
on
my luck. Yeah. My luck, I'll organize it. We'll go into lockdown the day it happens again. So,
yeah.
When COVID is, I'll try it then.
Mm. So, all those that Cam listed, one of my favorites was in the Cold War podcast where you were speaking about Ho Chi Minh. Love that stuff. So, that was good. Mm.
So, we did a really big deep dive on the Vietnam War and Ho Chi Minh, and well, we haven't really gotten to the Vietnam War yet. We haven't really got up to the American involvement, but we did the early stages of him trying to get rid of the French and the Japanese, and then the French again, and yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, the guy you described seemed in the end quite an honorable guy and sort of not really the psychopath that people might have thought if you hear the name Ho Chi Minh, oh, he must have been a psychopath. And in fact, he was just
he was fucking he was Jesus, man. He was really Jesus. He was like this nice, I mean, I was going to say nice old guy, but he literally spent his entire life from the age of 19 through to when he died in his late 60s, early 70s, as a freedom fighter trying to free Vietnam from colonial oppression. It was dedicated, and he was poor for the vast majority of it, living in little mud huts. I just watched Platoon, Oliver Stone's Platoon. If you haven't seen that since listening to my series on Ho Chi Minh, it's worth going back and looking at it with that viewpoint, you know, these Vietnamese just trying to kick in yet another wave of colonial invaders out of their country, led by Ho and his team. So thank you.
So there's my tip, dear listener, get onto the bullshit filter. If you're not sure amongst all those which to support, go to the Cold War podcast and head to the one about Ho Chi Minh. That was good. So
it's probably free too.
Really?
Well, what we're doing now is all our archive episodes up until the current year. So all of the archive episodes of Renaissance, Bullshit and Cold War free. It's only the current year of episodes, like 2021 episodes, that are under the paywall. With the Caesar show, it's the reverse. The old episodes are under the paywall and the current stuff is free. I don't know why. I'm just testing different economic formats, models.
Right. Very good. And if you want to learn to invest, it's the QAV one. So all right, Cam. Well, I really appreciate having you come on and make life easy for me for a week where I could just let you give you a few words.
When are you going to return the favor? When are you going to come on my show and talk about Leonardo da Vinci for a couple of hours?
Oh, I could probably do the COVID one if you want help on that. I've been battling COVID conspiracy theories for a while. I'm sort of up to speed on a fair bit of that. So
Ray's going away. Ray's going on yet another vacation. So
right. Yeah.
Okay. Week after next is going to be my COVID deep dive week.
And when does Ray go away?
Week after next, yeah. Oh, he's away for a week or 10 days or something, so that's what I'm doing while he's away.
Okay. Well, sign me up. There we go. I'll be up for that one.
Good eyes.
Very good.
Trev.
Thank you, dear listeners in the chat room. You've been magnificent. For some reason, it didn't play on your Facebook page. Cam, we're going to investigate why. Just the technology didn't work. But anyway,
I'm blaming Joe.
We'll work something out.
And RIP and my condolences for Peter too.
Yeah.
I only met him that once when we had lunch together, and my kind of guy. I was very fond of him.
Yeah, that was really fortuitous because I did listen to my friend Peter. I had a love of the Bible in terms of its as a historical document. He loved talking about the letters of St. Paul as to whether that proved the existence of the historical Jesus. And I was having either a coffee or a lunch with Peter every week. And in the back of my mind, I thought, gee, it'd be good to get Pete with Cam one day. And I was driving to pick up Pete. And at that moment, you rang and said, what are we doing? You know, you want to have a cup of coffee? And I said, great. I'll put the three of them together. And we went to a coffee shop and the two of you just went hammer and tongs over chapter and verse, literally, of the Bible and of Paul. And it was really good. Pete enjoyed it. You did. It was a really good conversation and one of the highlights for me. So, yeah, it was good.
It was great. Yeah. It was lovely.
All right, enough reminiscing, dear listener. Talk to you next week with the panel. We'll be back then. Thanks, Cam. Talk to you later. Bye.
Cheers.
I think that allowing for the book being, after all, a parody, something like 1984 could actually happen. This is the direction the world is going in at the present time. In our world, there will be no emotions except fear, rage, triumph and self-abasement. The sex instinct will be eradicated. We shall abolish the orgasm. There will be no loyalty except loyalty to the party. But always there will be the intoxication of power. Always, at every moment, there will be the thrill of victory, the sensation of trampling on an enemy who is helpless. If you want a picture of the future, imagine a boot stamping on a human face forever. The moral to be drawn from this dangerous nightmare situation is a simple one. Don't let it happen. It depends on you.
Well, dear listener, did you enjoy that episode of the podcast? If you did, I've got a favour to ask. First up, tell some friends. Let them know about the podcast. You'll be discussing something at some time and you might be repeating something I've said. And when you're talking to your friends, say, hey, I heard this on this podcast and it's worth listening to. And maybe pick an episode that you think's a good one and direct them to it. Like, grab their phone and go to their podcast app and search for Iron Fist Velvet Glove and subscribe on their behalf, on their phone, and just put the word out. The other thing is you could become a patron and support the show. So if you go to our website, you'll see a link to Patreon, and there are some different options for subscribing and paying per episode. And really, the amount that you pay depends on what you get from the podcast. So there's different levels ranging from $1.50 Australian to, I think, $10 and various ones in between. It's really, what do you think it's worth? Is it worth a cup of coffee? Is it worth more than that, less than that? Whatever you get out of it, because not everybody gets the same. Maybe you don't listen to the whole thing. Maybe you never talk about it with people. Maybe you really couldn't care less half the time whether the podcast is there. It'll be different for everybody. So if you get a lot out of the podcast, contribute a bit more. If you don't get much, contribute less. But in any event, you can subscribe there. If you don't like the idea of a regular subscription, the website has a link to a PayPal donation. So you could just do a one-off donation every now and again. So there you go. It'd be good to spread the word, get a few more listeners. And that way, look, if we ended up getting more listeners and more money, we could do maybe a second episode or more special episodes, provide some more content. So it's up to you. If you think it's worthwhile, let people know. Thanks.